Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. It is November 12, 2019, 7 o'clock on the East Coast. This is another live edition of the Ant Canary Experience. I'm your host. You know my name. It is cold. I will say that coming to you live from southeast section of North Kakilaki, and we are freezing our balls off down here, and hell, most of the country is freezing tonight. It's going to be cold tonight, and it's going to be cold tomorrow. And I hate the wintertime. case I haven't told you before, the wintertime sucks. And it's going to be cold tomorrow. And I ain't going to keep saying it, but it's going to be freezing. I hate the wintertime. Anyway, tonight's show, yesterday was Veterans Day. And I've got, you know, family and friends that have either been in the military or still in the military. And, you know, I think that, I don't know who said this, but somebody said, you know, we wouldn't have so many veterans if we wouldn't have so many wars. And that's true. So tonight we're going to talk about the history of African-Americans in the United States military. Usually I have 5 clips per show. Tonight we're going to have 6 because what we're going to talk, we're going to talk about that, but we're going to talk about other things. We're going to talk about the African-Americans in the military. We're going to talk about a government institution, something that the government created. They put into place, and it still affects a lot of black people and minorities today, and it ties into this, and I will get into it, a system called redlining. And I've talked about this before, and it does play a part in what we're talking about tonight. We'll get to that. And also we're going to talk about how many wars how many wars has America been in? And the last time I counted, matter of fact, I did a show on this when I first got started on the in the network. I did a show on the wars that America was involved in, and I had a 5-page list of wars that America has been involved in, and I read every single war that America has been in, and that last count, about 61 wars that we have been in America. So that means pretty much America has been to war with about every country on this planet. Our military budget is off the chain. That's why we can't afford health care in this country. That's why we can't afford good schools in this country. That's why we can't afford a lot of stuff in this country, because we spend a lot of money on the military. Now, we do need to have protection, and I understand all that, and people understand that. But every time someone says that, you know, we need to do something about the health care situation in this country, usually you're going to get people saying that we can't afford it. Well, we can afford to buy tanks, and we can afford to buy planes, and we can afford to buy all kinds of stuff that, you know, we're not using, but we can never afford the things to help people in this country. We'll talk about that. This week is going to be interesting. I'll talk about 2 things. I just found out tonight that Colin Kaepernick is going to have a he's going to have something going on where he's going to be doing some drills in front of NFL representatives on Saturday. So he may come back into the league. Seems to me that the only people mad about this are the rednecks that got mad because a black man decided to take a knee against racism and police brutality. He's the only people that are mad about that. They've been mad ever since he did this. And I keep asking, why y'all mad? You know, and I've done shows on this. I've talked about this for the longest. And I'll remind you again, just in case I just said it, the reason why he took a knee was against racism and police brutality. He did not take a knee against your military. He did not take a knee against your flag. He did not take a knee against your national anthem. And he said it. And we already know this. But as usual in this country, unfortunately, this country is full of a lot of racist assholes, and let's just be honest about it. And those are the ones that are mad about it. Nobody else can be mad about it but them. You know, how dare that Negro take a knee and all this kind of stuff. These are the only people mad about it. And they blackballed him out of the league for years, and they know it, and we know it. So hopefully he gets to get a job. But, I don't even argue with those asshats anymore because it's a waste of time. It's a waste of time arguing with them. You know, it's like arguing with a wall. It's like trying to argue with the toddler. It's not going to get you anywhere because they don't want to listen. They think they know it. They don't know anything. But yet and still, you have these races in government. You have these races all over the place doing whatever the hell they want to do. But whenever you have somebody speaking out against it, all of a sudden, the races got something to say and they want to try, you know, they try to flip it around. You know, what's funny about that, the races want to make, you know, the people that aren't racist, racist, because it makes them feel better when they get called out on their racism. So I hope he gets a job somewhere because he's, you know, some of these backups that they got playing, you know, they blackballed him. They knew he was blackballing. And for them to deny that they blackballed him, they're lying. And people with brains and people that's been watching this game long enough, we know the deal. He already knew it. So I hope he gets a job somewhere. And these racist asshats will just go somewhere and sit down and shut up. But they'll still have something to say because, you know, that's all they do is talk. They talk. They can't, you know, they can never stand up and say anything. They just talk, blah, 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 yada, yada, yada. They have nothing else to say. And then another thing, that I want to talk about right quick. And I'm sorry. Let me give the phone numbers out. If you want to call in, 563-999-3682. 563-999-3682. And I got a call on the line. I'm going to hit that in just a second. But let me just say this. Tomorrow, the impeachment proceedings take place. And that's important because right now, we have people in government that have no business being in government. We have people that think that they can just do whatever they want to do, say whatever they want to say, lie about whatever they want to lie about, and get away with it. And the people that are against it are the people that, you know, I've said this before, that, you know, unfortunately in this country, white people can get away with a lot of stuff because they made the rules. And when you make the rules, you can break the rules, and you can bend the rules, and you can mold rules to do or look like anything you want them to look like. So this guy, I don't consider him my president. Him and his administration are the most crookedest people you ever want to see. The Republican Party is crooked as hell, and this guy and his minions break the laws. They do whatever they want to do, and then when they get caught, all of a sudden it's somebody else's problem. And they've been blaming all kinds of stuff on Obama for years, and Obama's not even the president anymore. But they start in the morning at 10 o'clock. They will be on almost every TV all over the place. And a lot of people are comparing them to Watergate, which I lived through. I was a kid, so I didn't know what the hell was going on. I was a kid. But then you go back in history and look up and see what Watergate's about. You know, it seems, let's face it, politics. You know, there are a lot of crooks in politics on all sides. But when you got one side that's complicit in this kind of stuff, you know, and it's money. All you got to do is trace all of this back to Russia, and this is all it's money. It's a money trail. It's money because, you know, what comes with money? Power. Once you get the money, what did Tony Montana say? Once you get the money, then you get the power. When you get the power, then you get the respect. I don't respect any of them, but they don't want to lose that power, but it's all about money. I think the Wu-Tang said it better. Cream. Cash rules everything around me. Dollar bill, y'all. And that's what this is all about. So It's all about the money. It's all about the moolah. Trace this all the way back. And this goes back to this wanting to build a hotel in Moscow. So this is what this is all about. And then he said he did something. Then he said he didn't do something. Then he tried to lie about it and said he didn't. Then he said he didn't do it. Then he said, well, I might have did it, but it's okay. Then he got his people saying, well, he might have did it. It might be all right. But then he said, well, I don't know. We think that's what he said. No, he didn't say that. But if he did say it, then it's okay if he said it because, you know, he's the president. He can say it. And, oh, yeah, you can't put the president in jail. You can't do this to the president because he's the president. But he can do whatever he wants to do. But if this had been, you know, happened on the other side, if you had, you know, the brother as the president, if he had done half of all of this stuff that Trump has done, he wouldn't even been the president. We know it. We know it. You know, you got, you know, and speaking about Veterans Day, you got this clown who had a foundation that he said he was going to do, you know, do stuff for the veterans. He ended up stealing millions of dollars from this foundation, and his fans don't seem to care. This is the same orange clown that, you know, wants to sit up and say, well, oh, I'm doing all this stuff for the military, you know. We're wonderful. Oh, and then he had the nerve to say that the military didn't have any bullets, so he's responsible for buying the bullets for the, you know. He just say stupid shit, you know, pretending that he loves the military, but then he wants to take money from the military and build a wall that ain't going to get built. You know, these people are two-faced. They are two-faced. They want to pretend that they're all about, they're pro-military, but then they do all this other crooked shit behind closed doors, and they want to stand in everybody's face and say, oh, yeah, we're wonderful, we're doing this. And why are there so many veterans sleeping on the streets? Why are there so many veterans that are sick? It's all about the money. You know, they talk out of their ass so much that it's not even funny, but then they want to pretend that they're doing more for these veterans than anybody has ever done. And they ain't doing nothing. All it is just talk. That's all this clown does is talk. You know. And we're still at war. We still got troops in certain parts of the world. You know. Matter of fact, the clip I'm going to play tonight about the military is very, very interesting. I'm going to save that for the last part of the show. But the history that we have with, you know, tonight we're going to talk about black people. There's, you know, other minorities in the military. You know, black people for, hell, centuries couldn't, you know, they weren't allowed in the military. Well, I won't say centuries, but I'll say this, that they weren't allowed in the military, but when they were allowed, they were allowed for a certain amount of time because America needed them. And then after they were finished with them, they just pretty much cut them loose. So there were a few that did fight in the Revolutionary War, and they fought in a few that were allowed to fight in other wars. They were some that were allowed to fight in the Civil War. They fought a few that were allowed to fight in WW1 and WW2. And these are the same. You know, they couldn't fight with the white soldiers. They had to be segregated. I probably did in the last show I did about this. I've been doing it. This was the third year. there was a something I read that, and this probably happened all through World War II, so it probably wasn't a one-time thing, that there were some German POWs that had been captured and transporting them to an American base. I'm not sure what had happened at. They had the German POW sit in the front of the bus and had the black soldier sit in the back of the bus. Now, you got to remember, this was back when, you know, black people had to sit at the back of the bus. And you have to also remember, too, that whenever enemy soldiers are captured, they can't be treated like, you know, they have to be treated with respect and all that kind of stuff, because, you know, if you treat an American soldier like shit, then, you know, America gets all bent out of shape. But, you know, we've seen instances where they did just the opposite. So they had the black soldiers sit at the back of the bus, and they had the German soldiers sit at the front of the bus. And some of these clips tonight, you're going to hear, there's one clip that you're going to hear about how our brothers were treated when they were over in England. And you're going to hear clips on how they were treated when they came back. And that's what we're going to concentrate on tonight. I mean, we're going to give history about, you know, we're going to tell the whole story, because the thing that kind of pisses, well, I ain't going to say kind of, it does, pisses me off, and the reason why I do these shows, especially with these holidays, and you've got two more big ones coming up, and I'm going to give you the whole story on those. Matter of fact, a couple of weeks, we're going to have the true story of Thanksgiving. And if you don't know it, you're going to find out about it. And it's what schools didn't teach you. And you're not going to like it. If you don't know it, you're not going to like it. So I'm going to give you that. And also, the main holiday comes up next month. I'm going to give you a scoop on that one, in case you don't know. Because it's not like what it seems. So I'm going to tell you the truth about that one. So this is a holiday. I mean, a lot of people had yesterday off. I mean, matter of fact, I live, I'm not sure how far I live, but I live pretty much down the street from a military base. So, you know, they had the day off, and people, you know, thank you for your service, all the other, you know, and they were getting discounts all over the place. You know, I ain't got no problem with that. The problem I have is when you tell only half the story. You know, you don't tell how our brothers and sisters were treated in the military. You don't tell that part. Only thing you do say is, you know, we're going to give you a discount on a mattress. And we'll give you 25% off a bag of socks. You know, they'll give you that. But they won't give you a whole scoop. And so this is what I'm here for. And also in one clip I'm going to play, and you may have heard of these services, the GI Bill, the FHA, you know, stuff like that, that white soldiers had access to, but our black soldiers did not. And there were women, black women were allowed to serve, but they couldn't serve on the lines and stuff like that. And they were segregated also. So our brothers were segregated, the sisters were segregated, and when they came back home, they did not get the same courtesies, the same chances to get in these programs that the white soldiers got. And the reason why I said something about redlining, because
that played into it, because when they came back, they were not allowed to buy homes in certain neighborhoods. They were what they call redlined out of certain neighborhoods, and this was all over the country. So these were men that risked their lives for this country. And when they came back, thinking that they were going to be, you know, what some people always say, you know, always talking about the American dream and blah, 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 they could not take part of it. They could not come home and buy houses for their families. They could not come home and go to college and get an education. Why? Because of the color of their skin. That's why. That's it. So when America, you know, always, you know, crying about, you know, we need your help. We need your help. Do this, do that, blah, blah, blah. And then when they get what they get what they get out of you, you know, then they just cut you loose. They just cut you loose. And then the story, the clip that I got about how the brothers were treated in England, pretty much Jim Crow was transported from America to England. And you're going to hear about, you know, soldiers being shot at. You're going to hear about soldiers being attacked. You're going to hear about all kinds of stuff. So, like I said, if you're going to, you know, I'm going to give you a whole story. I'm not giving you bits and pieces. I'm not giving you whitewashed information. This is all chronicled information. This is all information that is, you know, and I say this all the time. If you don't believe what I'm telling you, you can always Google it. You know, I'm like that episode of A Good Times. Michael had to go to the Black History book to get the information because he wasn't getting it in school. That's this show. It gives you the information about stuff that you don't get in school. You get only half of the story, and I'm giving you the other half because our soldiers won't treat it right. And it's a damn shame that the books won't tell you, that the teachers won't tell you. All they'll tell you is, yeah, we want the war against Hitler and his crew and all that kind of stuff, blah, blah, blah. But they don't tell you everything. So I'm going to tell you everything. So let me grab my book, and I'm going to tell you what the, we're going to start with the first clip. Matter of fact, this is going to be the history of African Americans in the military. Like I said, and a matter of fact, if you've forgotten, Crispus Attucks was a black man. He was killed when the Revolutionary War began. To the other clips too, because the other clips are interesting too, and some of them, once you hear what's in them, they might piss you off. That's cool. Be pissed, because you should be pissed. 563-999-3682. I did have a call on the line. I think it might have dropped. So if that caller is still listening, if you can call in, feel free to call back in, and I'll get you called. Okay, so we're going to play this clip and I'll be right back.
African Americans have a very proud legacy of service. I think that's part of our history, part of our heritage.
From Bunker Hill and the forts of South Carolina to the mountains of Afghanistan, African Americans have served with honor throughout our history. Black soldiers helped bring peace to the plains and defeat fascism in Europe. They charged up San Juan Hill, shot down Japanese Zeros at Pearl Harbor, and aimed for new heights at Tuskegee. By the end of the 20th century, an African American had risen to command the mightiest military force in the world. But African Americans have also had to fight for their right to defend their country and to receive fair and equal treatment in the military.
It's a challenge, and if you succeed, you come out stronger.
The legacy of their struggle and of their courageous service helped our nation realize its highest ideals of freedom.
Because of the people who served, I'm able to sit here and talk to you right now and breathe this air of freedom.
One of the first casualties of the War of Independence was Crispus Attucks, a black merchant seaman killed in the Boston Massacre of 1770. Slaves and free black men fought together in the Continental Army, but after the Revolution, African Americans were largely barred from serving. Some ignored the ban and fought valiantly in the War of 1812. Among the most famous black units of the Civil War was the 54th Massachusetts Regiment, whose heroic assault on Fort Wagner in South Carolina became legendary for the display of bravery against all odds. Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation prompted thousands of freed and escaped slaves to fight in the Union Army and Navy. Their brave efforts helped to defeat slavery and gain the vote for African Americans. After the war, the Army maintained a number of black units. In the West, they helped preserve order on the lawless frontier. Native Americans called them Buffalo Soldiers. Among their feats in the Spanish-American War, the all-black 10th Cavalry Regiment assaulted San Juan Hill. With America's entry into the First World War, heroic units of black soldiers included the 369th Infantry Regiment. Known as the Harlem Hellfighters, they served on the front lines longer than any other American unit. They also introduced the French to Le Jazz. A little over 20 years later, thousands of African Americans served courageously. During the bombing of Pearl Harbor, Dory Miller, an African American Navy steward, manned a machine gun to shoot down Japanese Zeros. African Americans continued to serve heroically during World War II, although in segregated units. Nonetheless, the barriers were slowly being broken. Black women were now able to enlist in the armed forces, and the number of black officers was increasing dramatically. Benjamin O. Davis Sr. had become the country's first African American general in 1940. His son, future Air Force General Benjamin O. Davis Jr., commanded the 332nd Fighter Group, also known as the Tuskegee Airmen. The 332nd had a perfect record during the war. They never lost a bomber that they had under escort to a German fighter. Their outstanding performance helped to bring an end to segregation in the military. In 1948, President Truman issued an executive order directing the military to give all soldiers equal treatment and opportunity.
There is no justifiable reason for discrimination because of ancestry or religion or race or color.
By 1954, the Army had become the first major U.S. institution to integrate. A decade later, during the Vietnam War, blacks and whites made up an integrated fighting force. Joe Wynn is a veteran of the Vietnam era. Today, he works with two organizations as an advocate for business opportunities and minority rights for veterans. Joe remembers the early 1970s as a time of challenge and change.
We were coming off of that period of the late 60s, the Black Power movement, peace movement. I would have to say there was racial tension, not only in Vietnam, but many of the bases stateside as well. We wanted more civil rights, fair and equal opportunities. Same type of individuals who are challenging you at home are challenging you in the military.
After Vietnam, black men and women volunteered in large numbers, and African Americans were rising in the ranks. Samuel Gravely, first African American admiral in the U.S. Navy. Frank E. Peterson, Jr., first African American general in the Marines. Hazel Johnson Brown, first African American female general in the U.S. Army. General Colin Powell's appointment as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff marked a high point in an extraordinary legacy of service. In Operation Desert Storm, he led U.S. Armed Forces to one of the most impressive victories in military history. Today, African Americans continue to reach for new heights, like Captain Bernice Armour, who served in Operation Iraqi Freedom and became the first African American female combat pilot.
My dad was in the military, my grandfather was in the military. I'm also standing on very, very strong shoulders from the people that came before me, black female pilots. Tuskegee Airmen, you know, General Peterson, first black aviator in the Marine Corps.
After 30 years as an Army nurse, Lucretia McClenny now serves as the director of the Center for Minority Veterans at VA. The center is an important resource that informs minority veterans and their families about VA programs, benefits, and services.
Were it not for the men and women who paved the way, who endured grave injustices, racism, prejudice, discrimination, they fought for generations who would come after them so that we could serve with honor and distinction.
Throughout history, African Americans have valiantly answered the call to defend our country time and again. With courage and determination, they have overcome obstacles to advance the cause of freedom. Their legacy of exceptional service continues to earn the respect of a grateful nation.
First clip, let me get this button. Hey, what's up, Brother Mo?
Hey, hey, how's it going, Brother Anthony?
Hey, what's up?
Nothing much, just chiming in so I can learn something new today.
Well, that's the whole object of this program.
I'm glad you called because let's see, which one is this?
I'm glad you called at the right time. I'm getting ready to play this next clip. This is the one that talks about how black soldiers were treated over in Britain during World War II. The thing that pisses me off about, you know, this stuff is that they don't want to tell you that it happened, but then the thing is, they were over there with the same job that the white soldiers were over there for, but they were still getting discriminated against. Not only were they getting discriminated here, but they were getting discriminated over there. So it's like this racism is just, you know, it's just all, it's everywhere. And these are the same black soldiers that volunteered to risk their lives for this country, and they still get treated like shit. It's jacked up. So get ready for, let's see, now this one's a good one. I'm trying to read my list. This one talks about how they were treated in Britain.
But the other clip I'm going to play tonight talks about how they were treated when they came back. So these men got you know. Anyway, I'm not going to say. I'll let the clips do the talking. So I'm going to play this next clip and just talk about how our brothers were treated over in Britain, trying to liberate them from, you know. Anyway, listen to this.
You wouldn't believe this. I tell people every day, we black troops went overseas to fight the Germans, but we had to fight the Yanks first.
George Taylor was a black soldier born in Culpeper, Virginia. At the age of 90, he told us his story of that time in Britain.
If I took a British lady to a movie or to a restaurant, I'd have to fight my way out. I'd fight the Americans. The American white troops weren't used to integration, so they couldn't stand to see a black man take a white woman into a pub or whatever.
Neil Wynn is professor of 20th century American history at the University of Gloucestershire and has written many books about African Americans and the Second World War. So just explain to us how segregated the U.S. Army was in the 1930s and 40s.
Well, actually, it was totally segregated. There was no integration at all when America entered the Second World War. And, of course, it was a considerable bone of contention amongst African Americans and particularly civil rights organizations at the time. There was a great deal of debate in Britain about how they should respond. And some people argued they should just accept the American practices, and indeed in the war cabinet, and it reached war cabinet level in 1942, there were very strong arguments, particularly from the Secretary of War, James Grigg, to accept segregation and indeed to accept the kind of thinking that lay behind segregation.
So what happened in practical terms?
Thousands of African Americans now appeared in small, out-of-the-way places. Yes, they were in Bristol, and yes, they were in Worcester, and yes, they were in other major cities, but they were also in places like the Forest of Dean, and they were in Cornwall. In fact, the heaviest concentration of African Americans was in the South and the Southwest. But it became an issue of conflict, and gradually what happened was that the American forces instituted practices in the locality to try and avert these conflicts. So literally, for example, in the Forest of Dean, the town of Cinderford was put off limits to African Americans. That was for whites only.
Well, the whole town?
Absolutely. Coleford in the Forest of Dean, on the other hand, was for African Americans. Tewkesbury, where there was a major concentration of both black and white American forces, they allocated certain days, Tuesdays and Thursdays and Saturdays, for white Americans, and blacks could go into town Monday, Wednesdays and Fridays. Some chip shops were for blacks only and some for whites only.
So this was a de facto segregation, really, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And this is what happens, that as one of the black observers says, that British practices and attitudes notwithstanding, by 1943, 1944, you have in fact got Jim Crow introduced into Britain.
There were incidents that made the papers. A riot in Preston resulted in the death of a black serviceman and became known as the Battle of Bamber Bridge. Teresa Boswell from Dudley befriended an 18-year-old black GI from the Deep South.
We're standing talking on the pavement, and I spotted three white Americans coming along the pavement towards us, and he looked very uncomfortable. Anyway, they came up to us, and the fair-haired one, he said to the coloured boy, he said, boy, what are you doing walking on the sidewalk? And what are you doing talking to a young white lady? So I said, he was just asking for help. I wasn't talking to you, miss, he said, I'm asking him. So as the boy went to speak, they pushed him into the gutter. That's the place for you, boy. I said, for your information, this is not called a sidewalk. It is called a pavement. And in Britain, I said, people of all colours are allowed to walk on the pavement. And as we were talking, the one at the back came up behind me. And all of a sudden, I felt it. His arms come right round me and hold me tight. I couldn't move my arms. They pushed this lad into the gutter, but this time they pushed him over. And they kicked him from head to foot. And they kicked him and they kicked him.
Later that same day, Teresa saw three black GIs being chased through the town. One ran into a shopping arcade, followed by an American military policeman.
The military police van pulled up, and I said, is he alive or not? I said, because it looks as though he's had his head bashed in. Oh, no, miss, he's dead. He said, that isn't what killed him. He said he was knifed in the heart. He was resisting arrest rather than be taken. He killed himself. And he looked at me, he said, you don't believe me, do you? I said, no, I don't. I said, I don't believe you. I said, those three black men, I said, were not rioting. They tried to run for their lives when they saw the military policeman coming down the road. And the chap that was killed in the doorway was the young man that had been beaten up at lunchtime.
Here again are the voices of some of those men, the group who have banded together when off duty as the American Soldiers Corps. They're a group of colored soldiers who are spreading goodwill wherever they go. Whenever their duties are permitted, they've been singing to thousands of people all over Britain.
Going to lay down my burden
down by the riverside, down by the riverside.
However beautiful the music, the wartime propaganda couldn't disguise the tensions between white and black GIs. But what did unite the troops was the mission ahead, the inevitable invasion of Europe. Many soldiers died on the Normandy beaches. Those who survived saw their lives change forever. And for the girlfriends back in Britain, romances which began in a local dance hall would lead to a new home in a new continent.
So even volunteering for this country and fighting for this country and doing all this country asked for them to do, they still got treated like shit. Not only over here, but overseas. Still got, you know, that good old American racism. Still went over there and they still got treated like second-class citizens. Minding their own business. You know. I could have done the whole show on nothing but that, but then they're like, no, that'd be too depressing. But that's just the way, you know, that's just the way it was. You know. They went over there, they did the job, they came back and got treated like shit. So, you know, it's messed up.
And, you know, Brother Anthony, one thing about that is, you know, we went and we fought for this country, and there hasn't been too much change. So still today, you know, we're being killed and all this stuff, but yet we so gung-ho to be country first, and this country has never put us first. It has never put us first. And, you know, it's really a shame. You know, me, I served in the United States military for 6 years, and, you know, on Veterans Day or a day, some people who know that I served, you know, they'll send me a message saying, thank you for your service. And honestly, sometimes I feel shame when they say that. Because here it is, I have given service to a country that has not returned the favor. And it doesn't seem as though they give a damn about returning it. It seems to be more and more what can they get from us versus being right with us. And, you know, I don't see that it's getting any better. It's just more and more of the same. More and more of the same. And, you know, I have several family members, even my wife, she's there, she's retired. Other family members retired from the military. I have friends who, you know, are a little younger than me, some a little older, some same age, was in the same unit that I was in, and their bodies all broke down. And it's like we give our all for America, and America has not given us anything, hasn't given us anything but more hard time and drama. I think that's wrong.
Matter of fact,
but,
you know, you said something. You said something there. You know, I think a lot of people, when they say, you know, they tell, you know, say thank you for your service. I think that's just something. To me, I think that's played out. I don't say it because I don't know. It just seems phony to me to tell people, you know, to tell, you know, thank you for your service. I don't know. It's just me. It just feels. It doesn't feel genuine, and especially telling it to minority narrative, I just don't feel comfortable telling them that, because, you know, there were reports that they've got white nationalists in the military, you know, so not only are they in their police department, they're in the military, and these are the same people that we send overseas to. You know, another thing they used to kill me when people say that, you know, they're out there fighting, you know, they're overseas fighting for our freedom. Well, how did my freedom end up in Iraq? That's just something that just it would bug me when people used to say that. But then, you know, you've got these, you know, minorities volunteering for this country, and the country just still treating them like shit. And I have a hard time with that. And that's. You know, that's why I don't thank you for your service. I mean, you know, I just have a hard time telling, you know, I salute everybody, you know, all my friends and family that have been in the military, I salute them. But for me to say that, I can't say it. So I don't say it. There's nothing against them. It's just, I don't feel comfortable saying that. And when you say that, wow. It's like, yeah, I just don't feel like saying it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It feels phony, you know. It doesn't feel, you know. If it was genuine, yeah, I can say it, you know. But I just can't, you know. Man.
That's true, you know. And I think that a lot of people really don't really realize that. And the way this government has treated soldiers, you know, they say when the NFL players was doing the knee that it was disrespecting soldiers, but the soldiers, quote unquote, gave their lives so you could bend the knee. And to not do so would be disrespecting the soldiers. That's what would be disrespecting. And it seems as though, you know, even Trump, he talks about, you know, nobody loves the military more than him. Well, then why is the VA still fucked up? You know, why are still soldiers still out there on the street? You know, why are soldiers still not having proper medical equipment? Huh? See, those things got to be answered. You know, the soldiers don't need lip service. They need actual facts. They need something to heal. They need help. They need help. They gave their all for the country, and the country just shit on them over and over.
Yep.
It's not fair. It's not right.
Yep.
You know,
this is the same country. Oh, no, you're good. In the same country that pretends to love them so much, don't do nothing for them, and it's just, you know, and when people like us bring that out and say something about it, it's like, Nobody's listening.
But they say it every day. Oh, we love the military, this and that. But we can't tell. We can't tell that you love the military because you treat the military like shit. Treat them like shit. And then want to sit here and pretend that, you know, that you're doing everything for them. No, you're not. You're not doing anything for them. So my thing is, if you're not doing anything for them, then quit pretending that you are and quit saying that you are when you're not. And Trump is just full of crap anyway. This is not about him, but I ain't gonna get started on that clown. But anyway, let me go to the next clip. This is a clip about how black soldiers were treated when they came back from the war. And you would think that they would come back from the war and be treated like heroes and all that. No. If that's what you think, just think the opposite. And I'm telling you that now so you don't get pissed when you hear it. But you'll hear how they were. But if you're thinking they came home to a country that had their, you know, hands out, you know, arms open, no. Nope, think the opposite. Be right back.
The World War had created a new impetus and a new competence in those writer Alan Locke called the New Negro. Thousands of blacks had migrated north to help build the instruments of war, and thousands of blacks had gone to Europe to fight in it. By the war's end, some 200,000 African Americans would serve their country in Europe in a segregated army. One all-black regiment, the 369th, would fight side by side with French soldiers as equals. In the end, the 369th spent more time fighting on the front lines than any other American unit. The men of the 369th earned an unprecedented number of French military honors, 171 Croix de Guerre, France's highest military medal. African American soldiers hoped that their patriotic service would earn them recognition, acceptance, and equality in American society upon their return.
African-American veterans returning to their towns south of the Mason-Dixon line found themselves set upon and spat upon and indeed brutally accosted.
I saw the black soldier fighting for democracy to make the world free. And these people came back expecting the blessings of liberty and full deserts of freedom coming back. And being denied it?
There was a whole upsurge of reaction that said, if you think anything has changed because of this war, you've got a second and third thought coming.
But the outspoken black leader, W.E.B. Du Bois, is urging the returning veterans to fight in a new battle.
Make way for democracy. We saved it in France, and by the great Jehovah, we will save it in the United States or know the reasons why. This country of ours, despite all its better souls have done and dreamed, is yet a shameful land. It gloats in lynching, disfranchisement, caste, brutality, and insults. By the gods of heaven, we are cowards and jackasses if we do not now marshal every ounce of our brain and brawn to fight a sterner, more unbending battle against the forces of hell in our own land. We return. We return from fighting. We return fighting. W.E.B. Du Bois.
On Sunday, July 27th, 1919, Eugene Williams, a 16-year-old black youth, crossed the invisible color line on a Chicago lakefront beach, trying to swim away from attacking whites. He drowned, igniting racial fires. Roving bands of whites beat and killed unsuspecting blacks. Blacks fought back. At the riot's end, 15 whites and 23 blacks were dead. Jim Crow, said the Chicago Tribune, had come north. The Chicago riot had become part of the racial frenzy. Racial clashes, massacres, even lynchings. In Florida, Georgia, Mississippi, Tennessee, and Arkansas. One organization stood firmly against this onslaught of evil, the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the foremost interracial civil rights organization in America. One man was becoming the unlikely hero of the NAACP's battle against racial terrorism. 27-year-old Walter White became the chief investigator of lynchings and massacres.
Walter White's task was to come into the South, and one of the heroic stories, and we don't tell it anymore. Here was a black man who had blue eyes and blonde hair, who risked his life going among the lynchers, passing as a white man, and got the names of many of white men who had been a part of lynch mobs.
At the NAACP, they thought White was risking his life. He knew he was. He wrote to his superiors,
"I understand that this is dangerous. I take full responsibility if anything happens to me, and I hold you not liable in the event of my injury or death. Walter White."
As the summer of 1919 drew to a close, White read a newspaper account claiming that black farmers near the town of Elaine, Arkansas, had incited an armed uprising against the local white community.
"I was eager to go to the scene and left for Arkansas on the first train after we had scraped up enough money for the fare." Walter White.
When White arrived, he discovered that black farmers, tired of continually being cheated out of their fair share of the cotton crop, had formed a union to sue their landlords.
"They were meeting in a Negro church in Hoopsburg. When a white mob fired on the church, the fire of the attackers was returned and one of the assailants was killed. The match had been applied to the powder keg. Within a few minutes, efficiently directed, heavily armed mobs swept over the countryside, hunting down and killing every Negro they could find." Walter White.
When the killing stopped, some said as many as 200 blacks had been killed. Hundreds were arrested, 12 sentenced to death for killing whites. But even as White was uncovering the evidence which would ultimately free all of the accused, he found himself suddenly in danger.
"I was interviewing some whites when a black man told me that my identity had been discovered and a lynching party was prepared for me. I boarded the first train out of Helena. The conductor said, 'You're leaving just before the fun is about to start. There's a damn yellow nigger down here passing for white, and the boys are gonna get him. And when they get through with him, he won't pass for white no more. No matter what the distance, I shall never take a train ride as long as that one.' Later in Memphis, I learned that news had been circulated there that I had been lynched in Arkansas that afternoon." Walter White.
As Walter White returned to the safety of the North, one of the darkest chapters of Jim Crow was about to be.
Okay. So, that's just a little bit of how they were treated when they came back. So there was no change. They were still treated like they always had been, you know. It didn't matter if they were wearing a uniform of the military. They were still blacks, and they were still treated like second-hand citizens, you know, second-class citizens. So you know, if there are people in this country that say that there's no racism in it. If somebody tells me that in my face, that there's no racism in this country, there's never been racist, I'm going to stick my foot right up in their butt. I'm telling you, it's just, oh, goodness. And there are actually people that believe that. But you have these people that volunteered to defend this country, and they're still cracked down and, you know, messed up.
That's very true, Brother Anthony. It is. It's very messed up, and it's also very disrespectful. I mean, can you imagine, you know, you going to fight the Korean War or World War I, World War II, and you get back here and you still call the nigga, or you still can't go in certain restaurants or places of business, you know, and you just went over to a foreign field fighting for a country that won't even stand up and fight for you. I mean, that's ridiculous. I remember when Clinton was president and he was thinking about taking, putting soldiers back in Iraq. And few people in my unit that had already been to Iraq, they said, well, look here, I'm going to tell you right now, if they bring them Humvees and say, we got to load up and go, I'm loading up my stuff and putting it in my car and I'm driving the hell away. Because it just doesn't make any sense that we still get treated like shit and other people get treated better. I mean, they, from what I understand, they let the white Germans, when they was captured, they let them ride on the in the nice side of the train, from my understanding, and blacks still had to go in the back. But yet, yep, here's an enemy that you giving him better treatment than you giving your own. Doesn't make a bit of sense to me. It doesn't make a bit of sense at all. I mean, you think about it. They were proud. Our people were proud to serve in the United States military. They were proud about that, you know. But then when they got home here in America, ain't nothing changed. Ain't nothing changed. Yeah, and that's sad because it's the same way today. Ain't nothing changed.
Yeah. What's messed up about that is, you know, they left the racist country to fight for this racist country, and then they come back, and they still got to put up with the same racist crap that they had to put up before they left.
And now
I understand what Muhammad Ali was talking about when they tried to get him to go to Vietnam. He was like, they ain't do nothing to me. You know, why should I go there and fight these people? And they ain't never done nothing. They ain't never called me nigga. That's what he said. Why should I go there and fight them? They ain't never done nothing to me. You know, you want me to go over there and fight these people for you? You sitting here treating me like shit. They ain't do nothing to me. They treat me better than my own country treats me. So yeah, I understand why he didn't go. You know, I understand exactly what he's talking about. And now the next clip I'm going to play is just, you know, and I don't want it to seem like it's just piling on and piling on, but I mean, this is just history. This is just the way it is. You know, some people may know about this stuff, some people may not know about it. But this ties into, like I said, I've got six clips instead of five. But this right here, this next clip ties into when these troops did come home. They, like the white soldiers that they fought with, were entitled to the same things that, you know, that they were entitled to. But unfortunately, they didn't get them. You know, they were entitled to the same benefits as the GI Bill and all this kind of stuff. Well, unfortunately, when they came back, they couldn't take part in these programs. And a lot of that stuff that happened then, you know, we still see it now. Because I've got it, like I said, I'm going to play a clip about redlining. People may not know what redlining is. Redlining was something that the government set up that discriminated against black people. And here you go, you know, these military members coming home thinking that they're going to get same benefits, and they didn't, which is jacked up. Now, I'm going to say it. It's fucked up. So here's the next clip I'm going to play for you. So let's listen. It's jacked up big time.
The ratification of the Servicemen's Readjustment Act, commonly known as the GI Bill, was an unprecedented achievement for the United States. Never before had a social policy attempted to rehabilitate veterans into American society in such a unique manner. The GI Bill allowed millions of veterans to return to school, purchase homes, and start new careers. While the plethora of new opportunities awaiting veterans after World War II represents one of America's greatest social triumphs, the disparity between the opportunities of white America and black America represents one of this nation's greatest tragedies. The widespread racism rampant in the American South allowed for de jure discrimination against African American veterans. While the massive triumphs of the GI Bill cannot be ignored, the inability of black GIs to effectively use their GI Bill benefits can in many ways be cited for the ever-expanding racial wealth gap in modern-day America. On July 28, 1932, Major George Patton began his initial march toward roughly 37,000 World War I veterans. Major Patton was tasked with dispelling the Aggravated Coalition, formerly known as the Bonus Army, out of D.C. where they were protesting. Suffering from the struggles of the Great Depression, Americans witnessed as Army veterans demanding payment for their services in World War I clashed with current military personnel. For the sitting president, President Herbert Hoover, the rise of the Bonus Army and the violence that erupted thereafter was politically debilitating, so much so that his successor, President Franklin D. Roosevelt, campaigned on supporting veterans like never before.
All of these rights spell security. And after this war is won, we must be prepared to move forward in the implementation of these rights to new goals of human happiness and well-being. For unless there is security here at home, there cannot be lasting peace in the world.
President Roosevelt's support came in the form of the Servicemen's Readjustment Act of 1944, also known as the GI Bill, signed into law on June 22, 1944. The GI Bill was written first by Harry W. Cumary, the Republican National Committee Chairman, and U.S. Senator Ernest McFarland. The benefits of the GI Bill aim to improve the economic conditions for veterans by offering otherwise difficult or unavailable opportunities. The bill's first benefit allowed the Veterans Administration to provide low-interest home, farm, and business loans. The bill's second component allowed unemployed veterans to receive assistance based upon the 5220 clause. For 52 weeks, a veteran would receive $20 a week while they were seeking work. The bill's third provision required the United States Employment Service to assist veterans in finding jobs catered to the skills they developed prior to or during military service. Lastly, the final provision paid for a veteran's education or vocational training for up to 4 full years. Future scholars would hail the GI Bill as the great democratizer and America's greatest single piece of social legislation. The 7.8 million World War II veterans who used their benefits to complete a degree or vocational training earned an average of $10,000 to $15,000 more annually than those that did not. Also, their increased earnings generated tax revenues 8 to 10 times greater than the total cost of the program. But shrouded in one of America's greatest policy triumphs is one of America's most detrimental tragedies. The rampant racism in the VA, combined with the underfunding and scarcity of HBCUs, led to a vast disparity in the use of GI Bill benefits between white and black veterans.
So the implementation of it was great. The challenge was that it did not address the systemic racism and discrimination in the country at the time.
While the intention of the GI Bill may have been to improve the socioeconomic status of veterans both white and black, the new VA mortgage policy instead led to the beginning of federally funded housing discrimination. In a Supreme Court decision, Buchanan v. Warley, it was declared unconstitutional for locally elected officials to uphold recently established racial zones in which African Americans specifically were to reside. It was reasoned that because locally elected officials were governmental representatives under the 14th Amendment, it was an infringement of property rights based upon race. However, the Buchanan v. Warley decision did imply that it was legally justified to make racially restrictive covenants in property deeds, since restrictive covenants were signed by individual property owners, and their racial discrimination did not constitute governmental action. The Supreme Court upheld this view in the 1926 Corbin v. Buckley decision. Like wildfire, racially restrictive covenants spread through the United States, restricting access to homes for African Americans.
Some of the GI Bill benefits were supervised by state agencies, and those state related to unemployment insurance, housing loans, business loans, and so on.
It were these racially restrictive covenants that the VA did not oppose for the sake of veterans' quality of life, but instead embraced. Not only did the VA hinder African Americans from areas where restrictive covenants were in place, but the VA also insured mortgages on homes with racially restrictive covenants. In other words, the VA was both approving white veterans to live in white-only neighborhoods while barring African Americans from living in the same neighborhoods, thereby insinuating the racist land policies they declared to protect African Americans from. It would not be till May 1948, well after many African American World War II veterans would attempt to utilize their GI Bill benefits for home loans, that Shelley v. Kramer and Heard v. Hodge would outlaw the enforcement of racially restrictive clauses in property deeds. But the damage had already been done. Local VA facilities across the United States had successfully barred black veterans from particular homes, leading to the ghettoization of minority veterans and their dependents. In 1947, a survey by historical scholar Howard Johnson found that despite African Americans making up a third of one southern state's population, of the 17,000 VA workers there, only 7 were black. The lack of representation of African Americans is not only important in understanding how the VA facilitated housing discrimination, but also important in understanding how widespread racism prevented African American veterans from pursuing a college education.
By 1955, they estimated that between 100,000 and 50,000 black GIs who had the government backing were turned away from historically black colleges and universities because they did not have the capacity to grow at the rate necessary to admit these guys.
By 1946, of the estimated 100,000 black veterans eligible to attend college under the GI Bill, only a fifth gained admittance. This was due to both the overcrowding and underfunding of HBCUs and the discriminatory admissions policies barring black veterans from pursuing an education elsewhere. Because 79% of the black population was concentrated in the South, in which educational segregation was required by law, many African Americans were forced to attend HBCUs, and many of these HBCUs were underfunded at best. Of all the HBCUs, only 5% were accredited by the Association of American Universities. None had an accredited engineering program, none had a doctoral program, and only 7 institutions had any graduate programs. On top of that, half of the HBCUs had fewer than 250 students. As an African American veteran, pursuing a college education was extremely difficult. Having to overcome discriminatory admissions processes, racist VA officials, and highly restrictive HBCU opportunities, it is extraordinary that many African Americans received an education due to the GI Bill at all. The Servicemen's Readjustment Act of 1944 was one of America's greatest political triumphs in the post-war era. Nearly 8 million Americans would benefit from the GI Bill and revitalize the American educational and economic landscape in the process. But embedded in one of America's greatest achievements was one of America's worst deficiencies: the federal government's inability to effectively protect African American veterans from housing discrimination and uphold black veterans' access to college education led to one of America's most significant disparities and has facilitated the creation of racial income inequality prevalent in modern American society. History shows that the federal government and America as a whole still viewed those same black veterans as both uneducated and unwelcome.
So on that clip, the narrator said the word ghettoization. In other words, if you ever wondered where the term ghetto came from or what ghetto means or how ghettos were created, the United States government created ghettos. And that goes into the next clip I'm going to play in a few minutes called redlining. So basically, ghettos were created because black people were not allowed to live in the same neighborhoods as white people. So, why is that important? That's important because these same soldiers that risked their lives for this country, they come back. They want to take part in the GI Bill. They want to get the same benefits that everybody else is getting. They can't go to school because schools were segregated. They can't live in certain neighborhoods because all that was segregated. So they had to go and live in bad neighborhoods on the bad side of the town. And their kids had to go to schools that were not, that did not have the same resources as the white schools, because like it is now, property taxes. So if the schools are jacked up, it's usually because they're in neighborhoods that are not rich neighborhoods. So the United States government created ghettos, in case you didn't know. And racist policies, I mean, that's just messed up. That is really messed up. And then they want to pretend like they, you know, they had nothing to do with it. They know what you're talking about. So the government did that. And so what redlining has to do with that is because when these same people were looking for places to live, what the real estate agents would do, they would have maps of the cities. They would draw colors around certain neighborhoods. The green colors were for the good sides of good sides of the towns where the white people could live. The red sections of towns, they were outlined in red. That's where they didn't sell a lot of houses. And that's where they would tell people not to live, certain people not to live in those neighborhoods. So that's why they call them redlined. So when these soldiers came back thinking that they were going to get, you know, be able to live in nice neighborhoods, not so much. So they were regulated to live in ghettos, what they call, or as, you know, some people call projects. You know, I always had an issue with that. It's like, you know, if you have, you know, because some of the projects, quote unquote, were apartments, but they won't call it apartments that black people lived in. They would call it projects. So if you have a mostly white neighborhood, you know, apartment neighborhood or whatever, they were never called projects. They were only called projects that black people lived in there. So that's where the term ghetto comes from. Created by the United States government. So this next clip is about the practice of redlining. Now, it still goes on to this day, even though they'll try to pretend and say that it doesn't. But it does. It does. They do it on the sneak tip. They won't come out and say it, but it still goes on. I'm going to play this, and then we'll be right back.
Are you looking for a new neighborhood to live in? Then come on down to Redlining Realty, sanctioned by the U.S. government. There's depressed infrastructure, underfunded schools, no white people. They're all in the suburbs. Heck, we'll even throw in free shoes. Now, doesn't that sound nice? Call Redlining Realty today, and we'll get you a house built on the most American foundation of all, racism. Today's baggage, redlining. Before we get into this BS policy called redlining that created housing segregation and pretty much jacked up the American dream for black folks, let's take it back to the 1930s. America is in the thick of the Great Depression, and y'all, it was bad. Around one-fifth of the country was unemployed, and nearly everyone was dirt poor. Along comes FDR with his New Deal. Dude was trying to revitalize the American economy, which created what we now call the middle class. But not so fast. FDR's New Deal would cement racial inequality in America for generations to come and birth two programs that enforced housing segregation, the Public Works Administration and the Homeowners Loan Corporation, known today as the Federal Housing Administration. The PWA created affordable housing, and surprise, surprise, the agency created separate public housing for black and white folks, greatly segregating cities. Now let's talk about the Federal Housing Administration. The FHA created low-interest mortgages to build homes across the country. This agency actually built the suburbs as we know it. They basically said, hey banks, if someone applies for a mortgage, go ahead, build them a house. Even if they don't pay you back, we'll still guarantee a loan. Unless they're black. The FHA's manual literally prohibited the occupancy of properties except by the race for which they are intended. But before we go any further, let me call on a friend to break down the legacy of redlining. The world-renowned white peopleologist from the roots, Michael Harriet. He's a nerd IRL. He's earned a master's degree in macroeconomics and even taught race as an economic construct to some college kids. What's good?
Feliz, what's going on? Good to see you in these Unpack That screeds.
How are these racist-ass races, government policies tie into what we now call redlining?
The term came about because the federal government, Uncle Sam then, created color-coded maps that told banks where they could give out housing loans. The green sections were a go, whereas the red sections, typically where black people lived, were deemed too risky. Even well-off black neighborhoods like Sugar Hill in Harlem, where black people like Dora Neale Hurston and Duke Ellington lived, were off-limits to banks. Aside from financial barriers, there were actual physical barriers to prevent black people from living in white neighborhoods. In the early 1940s, there was a 6-foot-high wall in Detroit because redlining, and it's still there today. The Fair Housing Act put an end to redlining in 1968, but we know it ain't go down like that. Banks across the country have been caught using redlining maps as recently as 2015. And get this, most redlined areas are still low-income black and brown neighborhoods.
So, FDR's New Deal pretty much screwed over generations of black folks to come. How else has redlining impacted black folks?
There's plenty, but three really stick out. Wealth, education, and criminal justice. First, let's talk about wealth. For y'all who don't know, home ownership is the primary driver of wealth. And who has a harder time getting homes?
Black people?
Bingo. Even when home ownership is an option, homes in black neighborhoods are, on average, valued around 25% lower than homes in white neighborhoods. This is the case across the board, even if the homes and neighborhoods are similar.
So off the bat, homes in black neighborhoods are less valuable.
Yep, and the plot thickens. People in redlined neighborhoods pay higher insurance premiums, they also pay higher interest rates, and are denied mortgages more often.
Hold up. We get a lot of our school funding through local property taxes. I bet that redlining impacts education too. How does that all work?
Let me ask a genius who can answer that question.
Yes, Michael, I am a genius.
No, not you. I mean Nicole Hannah Jones. She's the recipient of the MacArthur Genius Grant and knows education like the back of her hand. See, I can hit her up on our special genius hotline. Funny, I don't see your name on the list. Nicole, tell our girl how redlining has impacted education.
We get most of our school funding through local property tax. That meant that black cities cannot produce as much money as white suburbs, which can tax at a very low rate on high property tax. And so you see vast disparities between how suburban schools that serve lots of white kids are funded and urban schools that serve lots of black and Latino kids are funded. And that all goes back to the legacy of redlining.
Wow. Did the Fair Housing Act help at all?
Once redlining and discrimination in lending and housing became illegal in 1968, we didn't rejigger all of the property values that had been directly related to redlining, which put a premium on white communities and put a much lower property value rate on black communities. It's not like we started from scratch and equalized all of these property values. We just continue to watch white communities accumulate more and more wealth and black communities be deprived. And of course, it's going to impact how schools can be funded.
Are there any places where we can really see the effects of redlining on education?
One place where you can really see this play out probably in the most oppressive way would be the city of Detroit, home to the most unequal school funding border in the country. And that's the border between Grosse Pointe, which is very, very wealthy and almost entirely white, which borders right on Detroit. The schools in Detroit are falling apart, and the schools in Grosse Pointe, one of them has marble floors.
Thanks, Nicole.
That was a lot.
The cycle doesn't end there. Redlining, education, and criminal justice are all related. Let me take you on a trip to one of my favorite cities, Baltimore. Here is the original 1937 redlining map of Baltimore. Even though blacks and whites use illegal drugs at about the same rates, black people are three times more likely to be arrested. And where do you think they go to fight this war on drugs?
I've seen The Wire. They go to the hood.
See the red areas on the map? That's the forbidden neighborhoods, remember? Now let's look at this data of marijuana arrests between January 2013 and October 2014. Here are the heroin arrests and the crack arrests. Drug arrests and poverty are almost exclusively contained in the redlined areas. Isn't that remarkable?
You pronounced racist wrong.
And getting out of jail ain't any easier. In Maryland, 13 of the 15 zip codes with the highest bails are in Baltimore's redlined neighborhoods.
Damn.
Yeah, so basically redlining created poor neighborhoods, which led to underfunded schools, more poverty, and more black people in prison.
Let me guess. And the cycle continues?
Like a dog chasing its tail.
So the hood ain't the hood because black people made it the hood. Rather, it was intentionally created by the government to oppress black people through a federal policy that would adversely impact them for generations to come.
Precisely. And there's more, but that's all we had time for in this here video. Almost every quantifiable indicator of white supremacy all lead back to the government-sanctioned policy of redlining.
Michael, you just ruined my whole day. This is the last time I invite you to this show. Bye, Michael.
Okay, and we've got one more clip to play, and this talks about the military. And I've said it before, I didn't make up the quote, but it's like, you know, we wouldn't have so many veterans if we didn't have so many wars. So why are we in so many wars? Well, this clip will tell you. Matter of fact, this is the last clip of the night. We're going to run over time tonight, which is fine. But this is the last clip, and this talks about why are we in so many wars. Play this and be right back.
The modern United States is the most powerful country in human history, with over 800 military bases and 37% of global military spending. The U.S. has become the leader of a vast, interconnected global system that has helped usher in an era of unprecedented prosperity and low levels of conflict. To understand America's position in the world, and why it's so pivotal for world politics as we know it, you have to go back to the country's founding, back to when America wasn't a global power in any sense of the word. During the first 70 years of its existence, the United States expanded in both territory and influence in North America, eventually reaching the Pacific Ocean, in a wave of expansionism that resulted in the wholesale slaughter of the indigenous people who populated the continent. But early Americans were deeply divided as to whether the country should expand beyond the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans. This became a major debate after the Civil War, when some leaders, like post-war Secretary of State Seward, argued that America should push to become a global power. Seward succeeded in pushing a plan to purchase Alaska from Russia, but his attempts to buy Greenland and Iceland, as well as annex territory in the Caribbean, were all blocked by Congress. That's because some Americans, including many on Capitol Hill, had a strong anti-imperialist bent. These people worried about America getting more involved in global politics, as well as having to integrate populations from quote-unquote inferior races. And this opposition implied major checks on the imperialist urge to expand. But something was happening in the late 1800s that would change the debate about American expansionism. The Industrial Revolution produced explosive economic growth, and the bigger U.S. economy required a more centralized state and bureaucracy to manage the growing economy. Power became concentrated in the federal government, making it easier for expansionist presidents, like William McKinley, to unilaterally push American influence abroad. The key turning point came in 1898, when President McKinley dragged the country into war with Spain over Cuba, despite some intense domestic opposition. The rising United States easily defeated the moribund Spanish Empire, acquiring Puerto Rico, Guam, and the Philippines in the process. Over the next 2 years, the U.S. would annex the Kingdom of Hawaii, Wake Island, and American Samoa. A few years later, the U.S. took control of the Panama Canal Zone and sent troops to occupy the Dominican Republic. It also purchased the American Virgin Islands. This period of rapid acquisition of far-flung territories put the U.S. on the map as a truly global power. During this time, America also began using its influence to protect its growing commercial and military interests abroad, installing pro-American regimes in places like Nicaragua, and playing a major role in international diplomacy regarding the Western presence in China. World War I showed just how much America's influence had grown. Not only was American intervention a decisive factor in the war's end, but President Wilson attended the Paris Peace Conference, which ended the war, and attempted to set the terms of the peace. He spearheaded America's most ambitious foreign policy initiative yet, an international organization called the League of Nations, designed to promote peace and cooperation globally. The League, a wholesale effort to remake global politics, showed just how ambitious American foreign policy had become. Yet isolationism was still a major force in the United States. Congress blocked the United States from joining the League of Nations, dooming Wilson's project. During the Great Depression and the rise of Hitler, the U.S. was much more focused on its own region than on European affairs. Ultimately, America's ever-growing entanglements abroad made it impossible for it to stay out of global affairs entirely. In East Asia, the growing Japanese Empire posed a direct threat to American possessions and troops, bringing the United States and Japan into conflict. This culminated in the Pearl Harbor attack, bringing the United States into World War II. World War II would transform America's global presence forever. The United States was the only major power to avoid economic ruin during the war, and it was the sole country equipped with atomic weapons. As such, it was in a unique position to set the terms of the peace, and, with the aim of preventing another war in mind, it took advantage. The most famous example of this is the creation of the United Nations. The UN Charter set up a system of international law prohibiting wars of conquest, like the ones waged by the Nazis and the Japanese. It also served as a forum in which the international community could weigh in on disputes and help resolve them. This way, the Americans hoped, great powers could resolve their differences through compromise and law rather than war. But while the UN is the most famous of the post-war institutions, it isn't the only one. 730 delegates from all 44 allied nations came together in a small vacation haven in New Hampshire. Their goal? To establish a global financial system that would prevent another Great Depression and World War. The resulting agreement, called the Bretton Woods Agreement, ultimately became the backbone of the global financial system, resulting in the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. By creating these institutions, the United States committed itself to being deeply involved in the world's problems. The issue, though, is that the world's second largest power, the Soviet Union, saw things differently. World War II had made allies out of the Democratic West and Communist East in the fight against Hitler, but that couldn't last. The United States saw Soviet expansion in Eastern Europe and elsewhere as a direct threat to its vision of a free-trading, democratic world.
To a substantial degree, in one form or another, socialism has spread the shadow of human regimentation over most of the nations of the earth, and the shadow is encroaching upon our own liberty.
Fearful of Soviet intentions towards Western Europe, the U.S. and other European nations created the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, a military alliance meant to stop Russia from invading other countries in Europe. Globally, the U.S. committed to a strategy called containment, so-called because it was aimed at containing the spread of communism everywhere on the globe. This new global struggle meant that the U.S. had to exert influence everywhere, all the time. Instead of disbanding the massive military machine created for World War II, the wheels mostly kept turning. This had two main results. First, the U.S. was pulled into unlikely alliances with countries like Saudi Arabia, Israel, and South Korea, seeing each of them as bulwarks against communist influence in their region. Secondly, the U.S. began intervening, often secretly, in dozens of countries to contain Soviet influence. Sometimes this meant propping up sympathetic dictators, like in Iran. Other times, it meant supplying rebels with arms and money, like in Afghanistan in 1979 and Nicaragua in 1985. Over the course of the Cold War, the U.S. intervened in hundreds of disputes around the globe, ending up with a complicated set of alliances, tensions, and relationships in basically every corner of the earth. After the Berlin Wall fell, the US could have withdrawn from the system, severing ties with its allies and drawing down the size of its military. And while the US did decrease military spending, much of the military infrastructure and alliances from the Cold War remained. Presidents George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton decided that it was in both America and the world's interest for the United States, now the sole superpower on Earth, to continue actively managing global affairs.
We should be and we must be peacemakers.
NATO, created solely as a tool for countering the Soviet Union, stayed together and even expanded, a way of keeping European nations united in the absence of the Soviet threat. Washington's support for countries like Israel and Japan stayed intact, ostensibly as a means of preventing war in their respective regions. The global system of alliances and institutions created to keep the peace during the Cold War became permanent, as did the American military and political commitments necessary to keep them running. This system remains in operation today, and no leading American politician since the Cold War has seriously called for dismantling it. Except, perhaps, for Donald Trump. Trump has said contradictory things about these commitments, but he's consistently argued that American allies are not paying the US enough for its protection, and questioned the value of free trade. That calls NATO and even the World Trade Organization into question.
At some point, we have to say, you know what? We're better off if Japan protects itself against this maniac in North Korea. We're better off, frankly, if South Korea is going to start to protect itself.
Saudi Arabia,
we have
their weapons?
Saudi Arabia, absolutely.
This is a sharp divergence from the consensus that has dominated U.S. foreign policy since 1945, and something closer to the isolationism that came before it. So will President Trump act on some of candidate Trump's ideas and reverse decades worth of institution building and alliances? We'll find out soon enough.
Okay, so that's the last clip of tonight. Went over a little bit later tonight. That's cool. But I just wanted to bring this to your attention whenever, you know, we celebrate these military holidays. How all our troops were not treated the same. How all our troops were not able to take part in a lot of these programs that were promised to them. So just try to remember that. That's all. So we're going to go. I want to thank Brother Mo for calling in. And thank you for listening. And we'll be back next week. I'm not sure what I'm doing next week's show on yet. But I guarantee you the show after that will be the truth about Thanksgiving. And it ain't pretty. So I'm done. I'm out. Peace out. See you next week.